Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald, and I think that out of all the children of former Major League Baseball commissioners, Paul Giamatti has to be one of the five best actors in that bunch. We are going to talk about everything that's going on in the baseball offseason. As of tonight, it is the evening of Tuesday, February 6th, 1 week from spring training, and still so much is going on. Some people hate how slow the baseball offseason is, and I get it this winter because it's been very, very slow, challengingly so. But the great thing about it is that months into the offseason, still so much is happening. So much so that I didn't even ask our listeners for questions this week. Apologies about that, but we just have so much to cover and only roughly 30 or 40 minutes to cover it. With me to cover all of that is my colleague Steve Adams. How's it going, Steve?
It is going excellently. I echo your sentiments on, I get the frustration with the slow off season. I've kind of always been, and granted, I think we're all at Trade Rumors a little biased in the sense that
what?
It's nice that it's I liked the slow grind of the off season even before I was in this line of work because it just kind of gives you something to look out for every day. Now for us, you know, from a business perspective as well, it's good to, like, you know, have things happening throughout the off season just mercifully for you and I and Anthony and the team from a just sheer workload standpoint. I look at the guys that are, you know, Pro Football Rumors and Pro Hockey Rumors and Hoops Rumors, our sister sites, and wonder how they just, like, even manage to get through. You know, free agency in the other sports feels like it lasts about 48 hours, and it's just like I can't even fathom, like, trying to, like, get through a day like that. So it's nice that it's kind of spread out for us workload wise.
It seems like the other sports, it's a challenge to get through the frenzy once, like, everything is happening. And then I would imagine it's also a challenge to, like, okay, what do we talk about for the next 3 months?
Right. Yeah. So I kind of like that. There's always, it's a nice, slow, measured pace. I've always liked that, even again, like, even, you know, going back to before when I was doing this full time, but, like, it's always, I like my baseball to last year round because I'm a big baseball dork. So that's, to me, I don't have a problem with it, but I very much understand the consternation that it causes a lot of fans. I get it.
It is always baseball season. And so, like I said, we have lots of big news to talk about. I think arguably the biggest, or at least the most unique, because we have some big trades and some big signings to get to.
Yep.
But signings and trades happen, as much as they are, like, fun and awesome when they do happen. But one thing that does not happen every day is that a team gets sold.
Correct.
There are only 30 teams, and generally speaking, when somebody buys one, they hold on to it for decades. And so this doesn't happen very often, but the Baltimore Orioles are being sold. So let's talk about that. And it's also interesting because the Orioles have given us so little to talk about for most of this offseason, just sitting on their hands. And now I'll spill the beans here. Both of our top two stories on this podcast are going to be Orioles related. You may have guessed.
Yeah.
They are finally giving us a lot to talk about. So let's talk Orioles. Steve, this sale, you know, what do you think? What are your thoughts? What should people know?
I think it's good for Orioles fans. It's hard to gauge. You know, they've obviously been in this long, drawn out arduous rebuild, which, understandably so. I don't often, like, advocate for teams to, like, tear things down to the studs and, like, completely rebuild. I think that strategy was overused throughout baseball for a while, and I think teams are kind of, like, some clubs are still doing it, but it's not as in vogue as it was when the, you know, Astros and Cubs did it in one World Series, like, back to back. But the Orioles had, like, reached a point where it was very much necessary. And when you get to the point where your roster is kind of just a collection of, you know, 30-something-year-old players with underwater contracts, and you have a bottom-ranked farm system, and especially in the Orioles' case, where they basically have, like, no international free agency infrastructure in place, yet they needed to just kind of tear everything down, start over, and they've done, you know, to their credit, a great job in doing so. But it's hard to know how much of the inactivity that they've had in free agency in recent years is solely because they're just aggressively tanking and building this thing from the ground up, and how much of it has been because the Angelos family under specifically John Angelos, because he was, you know, named the control person over his brother after all the infighting and the drama when the members of the family were fighting over control of the franchise. But he really hasn't seemingly wanted to greenlight much in the way of spending. Under Mike Elias, who I believe is in his fifth offseason as Orioles general manager, he was hired at the end of the 2018 season when they moved on from Dan Duquette. He had never signed a free agent. He still hasn't signed a free agent to a multi-year contract. Even like a reliever to like, you know, a 2-year, $8 million kind of, that's never happened. They've never given a free agent more than the $13 million that they gave to Craig Kimbrell earlier this offseason. They haven't signed extensions with any of their exciting young players. And so you wonder, like, okay, is this just ownership doesn't want to commit anything because, hey, we're rebuilding and we're going to, you know, we're not going to commit much in the way of finances? Or is it more, you know, hey, we're looking to sell this. We don't want to put any long-term debt on the books or anything like that. And now that they have a buyer and somebody who's going to, you know, a very, obviously, if you're buying a major league team, you're very wealthy. But David Rubenstein seems, you know, even wealthier than some of the other owners who have purchased franchises in recent years. Does that mean that they are now going to also be willing to field more competitive payrolls? If that's the case, that's a horrifying thought for the AL East and for baseball in general, because the young core that they have built up is already so enviable. And they won 101 games last year with whatever, I don't have the payroll number in front of me, but well under $100 million, you know, in the $60 to $80 million range. If they're a team that now with new ownership is you know, long-term and looking ahead, going to be willing to say, okay, hey, yeah, we'll bring payroll back up into the mid 100s. That's pretty frightening for the rest of the league. So I, and if you're an Orioles fan, pretty damn exciting, I would think. So curious to see once the sale is approved by the rest of the owners, which I assume that's largely a formality at this point, but it'll probably be a little bit before they push everything across the line and finalize it. But I'm curious, you know, what that brings about and what future Orioles off seasons are going to look like, because yeah, for the past 5 years, it's just been, you know, crickets in terms of their free agent acquisitions. They haven't really taken on any contracts for notable veterans who are making much in the way of salary at all. So yeah, you add some free agent and some trade and some offseason aggression to that core. And obviously, like a team that's phenomenal at drafting and developing players and finding talent on their, you know, new international program and everything. It has the potential for a real long-term powerhouse in the AL East.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we don't know, because it's entirely possible that the new ownership will behave in the same way. But it, I mean,
it's a pretty low bar to clear the payroll levels that they've been at in the recent year.
I was just going to say, like, I mean, even the comment, I mean, because we don't know how Angelos feels about things in private. I mean, I was just watching an interview today with Zach Britton and Adam Jones, where they both had nothing but nice things to say about their relationship with John Angelos when they were with the Orioles. But at the same time, you know, whenever he opened his mouth, it didn't inspire a lot of confidence. You know, I think at one point he was like, oh, we're trying to model ourselves after, you know, the Rays and the Guardians and, you know, these low payroll teams. And then he also had some comment where somebody asked him about extending, you know, young players like Adley Rutschman or whatever. And he was like, well, if we were going to do that, we would have to raise all the prices on everything in the stadium because we have no money. And then he pulled out his pockets and some butterflies flew out to illustrate how broke he was or whatever. And it was sort of, it didn't give a good feeling, I don't think, for a lot of Orioles fans. And a lot of them were very excited from what I saw online that the sale was happening. And so, like you said, it's a low bar. Like, it could hardly get worse in terms of investing in the team because they were basically not investing at all. But I mean, give credit to them for hiring the people who have been building this farm system and all that kind of stuff. Like, clearly some good decisions have been made
there
to get them to this place, even if they don't involve big financial investments that we can see in terms of
player salaries. I was going to say, I think they probably invested in ways that we haven't seen, like building out an international scouting department and building the academy that they have in the Dominican and all these things. Like, they have been putting money into the team, but not in visible, tangible ways for the fan base. And it's also, you don't know how much that costs. So like, we don't know, like, is that, are they spending tens of millions of dollars to do this? Or are they spending like a few million dollars and it's the price of like adding a couple of relievers? We don't really know because the numbers on those sorts of investments don't become public. I will quit interrupting you and let you continue making your point.
No, that was, you said that well, and that was essentially what I was getting at, which is that, you know, we don't know what it's been like behind the scenes, but yes, in a lot of, outward facing ways, you know, a lot of Orioles fans are really, really excited about this. And we don't know, like I said, we don't know what this new regime is going to behave like, but there are a lot of Orioles fans who are like, anything is better than this. So good for them. And like you said, it will be scary if it's any kind of improvement at all in terms of investing in the roster in an immediate way, because it's already one of the best rosters in baseball.
Yeah, they don't need to start spending $200 million. If they said like, hey, we're going to start spending $140 million a year, it's like the rest of the AL East is going to go crap. Like, okay.
Yeah.
So it's exciting for them.
I mean, I know it's almost sort of obvious to compare them to the Astros because both clubs did the big tank, and even, you know, a lot of the behind the scenes personnel has been the same. But I was just reading an interview with Jim Crane today before the Altuve extension. And somebody pointed out that I think it was like, I don't know, whatever it was before the Astros were good, let's say like 2010, something like that. They had a payroll of like $25 million.
Yeah.
And so the Orioles in a lot of ways are on that same trajectory. It feels like where for so long they were this bottom feeding joke and, you know, the good times are ahead. They're on the way up. So anyways, we will see, but it's potentially a massive franchise altering development, but we will see. We'll have to wait and see on how it gets executed. Like I said, most people who buy a baseball team, they own it for decades. So we'll see how this ownership group fares between now and 2070 or whatever. And we'll judge them then. Okay. So that's a lot on the sale. Let's turn to the other big Orioles news, which is far more immediate, which is that they got an ace. Like I mentioned earlier, they had been doing nothing all winter long, and then they were like, here you go, huge deal. They got Corbin Burnes from the Brewers for, they gave up Joey Ortiz and DL Hall and a draft pick. What do you think, Steve?
I think it is the kind of move that, you know, this is what contending teams do, and this is what you expect a team in the Orioles position with like the best farm system in baseball, 101 win season in 2023. This is what you expect them to do. They have more prospects and more young kids than they can possibly, like, you know, get at bats for around the field. And at a certain point, like, yes, Burnes is a rental. No, I don't think he's going to sign a contract extension there as a Scott Boras client and former Cy Young winner who's a year from free agency. And that shouldn't, you know, detract from the fact that like they went out and they made this win now move in pursuit of a very realistic chance at winning a championship this year. I think, honestly, I thought they did well in not surrendering anyone from the very, very, very top end of their farm. Like, not to say that Hall and Ortiz are, you know, nothing prospects. They're both guys who've drawn, you know, a ton of fanfare on top 100 lists and the like over the past few years, including, you know, placement on some current prospect rankings along those lines. And they're both, you know, major league ready guys who are going to step right onto the Brewers roster. So it's not an insignificant loss of talent necessarily. And, you know, one Corbin Burnes injury or like an unforeseen just like collapse and the trade will look poor for them. But this is the type of move that you should be making in their position. I think, you know, they avoided giving up a Jackson Holliday or a Colton Cowser, or Kobe Mayo, some of their most highly regarded prospects, and traded away guys who are kind of at positions of some organizational depth. Ortiz specifically as an infielder, they don't necessarily have a place for him to play every day long term when they also have Gunnar Henderson and Jackson Holliday and Jordan Westberg and Connor Norby and Kobe Mayo, and the list goes on. Like, they're just deep in infield talent. So I thought it was a reasonable enough price to pay. I think Burnes is a slam dunk upgrade at the top of that rotation. I know last year wasn't necessarily his best year, and he had like one kind of particularly rough stretch over the course of the season, but I think, you know, teams by and large, look at this guy as a clear-cut number one starter. He is an obvious game one starter in a playoff scenario, difference maker for the rotation. And I think they did very well. I think the Brewers' return generally is fine for them, is good for them for 1 year of a not inexpensive pitcher. I think they came away nicely as well. It's a trade that I like for both clubs. But this is the sort of move that, like, you've been waiting for the Orioles, rather, excuse me, to make, as this young core has kind of come to maturation, and they just haven't. And they've been adding Jordan Lyles and Kyle Gibson and, you know, just like kind of these like lower, like higher floor, but like lower upside veterans who aren't going to be difference makers. And this is the type of move that you love to see them make. They'll make Burns a qualifying offer at the end of the season and recoup, you know, a really strong draft pick if and when. I mean, I shouldn't say when. We'll see how the new ownership treats that situation when it comes about. Maybe they'll try to pay market value to keep him in Baltimore long term. We'll see. I don't think it'll be an extension, but at the bare minimum, they'll get that qualifying offer draft pick compensation next offseason, and they'll get, you know, 200-ish, probably really good innings out of Burns, and quite likely, you know, a few playoff starts out of him, potentially quite a few if they are able to go on a deep run. So I really like it for them. I said in my chat on the site today, I don't even feel like it needs to be done. They still have that it needs to be the stopping point for them. They still have a really clean long-term payroll outlook. They still have a super deep farm system. If they wanted to go out and now trade for Dylan Cease or something, they still could. I mean, like that's like the really scary part about, you know, how stacked that Orioles farm system is that sure, they gave up two really good players to get Corbin Burns, but they could go out and get almost anyone on the trade market still without really weakening the major league club and make their rotation even scarier, even deeper, even stronger. So, I think it's a great move. I think Orioles fans should be excited. This is the type of transaction that they have rightly been waiting for. And it's a really good time to be a Baltimore fan.
Terrifying, terrifying. Dylan Cease and Corbin Burns and Kyle Bradish and Grayson Rodriguez.
Yeah. To be clear, that is pure speculation. But they have the pieces to do that. And like, Cease costs $8 million this year. Like, and you have him for another year after this. Like, why not go do it? Honestly.
Yeah. But it's a great, a win now move for a team that should be trying to win now. Yes. And they haven't even really, looking at the trade in a vacuum, it's possible that it can look bad if any of the players they gave up, turns into a long-term piece for the Brewers. But those are the chances you have to take when you're trying to win now. And even so, like you mentioned, the Orioles have so much talent that even if they're going to be fine.
And I don't think it even looks bad if Burns goes out and has a great season and finishes, you know, top five in Cy Young voting this year and wins a playoff start or two for them or whatever. Okay, if Joey Ortiz ends up as a, you know, everyday infielder in Milwaukee, which he very well could, and makes an all-star team or two, that's just a win-win trade for both parties. I don't think that makes it look bad for the Orioles. It's just like, yeah, you gave up commensurate value to get a clear number one starter.
Right. I mean, that's not the worst case scenario, though. I mean, worst case scenario would be like, you know, he gets injured and he's pretty useless to the Orioles and then they gave up something. But, you can't let that stop you from if you have that mentality, you'd never get anybody. So
exactly.
So you have to put it down, put the prospects down, get it done. And he makes them so much better in 2024. So let's focus on the Brewers then for a second, because, you know, on this podcast last week, we were talking about the Rhys Hoskins signing.
Yeah.
And I was talking with Anthony and we were just sort of like, or I was saying, you know, the Brewers looks like it's going to be a fairly quiet offseason. Like they lost Woodruff to the, you know, the injury and had to non-tender him. And then they add Hoskins. And so the roster is pretty similar. Looks like they're just sort of going to run it back and see if they can win the Central again. And now the whole thing looks completely different just 1 week later after this deal. So let's talk about the Brewers with this deal. And also, like, you mentioned that the Orioles might not be done, but like the Brewers probably aren't done either, right?
I wouldn't think so. But it's, you know, I was asked a lot today talking with readers on the site in our chat, like, you know, well, who are the Brewers going to trade next? And what's got to be Willie Adames next? When is Devin Williams going to go? Who are they? And I think there's this temptation when a team makes a trade of this magnitude to assume, because of kind of what we alluded to, or what I alluded to before, talking about how in vogue, you know, full scale rebuilds and everything were for a few years there. I don't think that it's necessarily a given that they're going to go out now and trade Willy Adames. I don't think that they're necessarily going to go out and trade Devin Williams. They'll stay open to it. You know, Matt Arnold, their general manager, said as much last week that he's not going to shut any conversations down at this point in the offseason, that he's certainly open to more conversations, I think was his wording. But I also don't think that they were, you know, hell-bent on trading Burns. I think they just, you know, throughout the course of the offseason had kind of set, we're open to talks, we're open to moving him if you meet, you know, XYZ, like this price point. And I think the Orioles, you know, finally came around and said, okay, we'll do it. I don't think that this is indicative of any like late stage offseason teardown or anything like that. You know, they turned around and yes, Jacob Junis is not going to, you know, replace Corbin Burns, you know, in a one-for-one, you know, in terms of value, but like, they turned around and quickly signed a starter with some upside to, I think, upside anyway, like really nice slider and kind of undervalued guy during his time with the Giants in that swing role, and somebody who looked like maybe if you gave him a larger role in rotation, you know, had some breakout potential. So I think turn around, make that move, and they still have some money that they saved from trading Burns and his larger salary. There's still a lot of talent on the free agent market. Not necessarily, you know, the Brewers aren't going to go out and sign Blake Snell now that they've traded, you know, Corbin Burns, but there's still talent out there for them to go and sign, trade opportunities for them to pursue. I think this is just a team, you know, that kind of is always going to perennially be in this spot of, I use the term threading the needle a lot when I'm talking about the Brewers and the Rays and the Guardians, but it's kind of what these teams do. Like they, you know, as their star marquee players that they aren't going to extend get closer and closer to free agency, they show an increasing willingness to listen to them, listen on them, and are generally going to focus on bringing back major league ready pieces in return, which the, you know, the Brewers clearly did here. DL Hall is going to come to camp and compete for a rotation job. And failing that, he has the makings of a high end reliever. Joey Ortiz will, you know, if not replacing Willy Adames as their long-term shortstop, will be a potential long-term option at second base or third base in Milwaukee. And the cycle kind of continues. You know, Matt Arnold, their general manager, came from the Tampa Bay Rays organization. He's very familiar with this type of churn as guys get close to free agency and everything. The Rays have made an art out of it. And I think, you know, he probably would like to emulate that in Milwaukee. I don't look at this as the onset of some teardown. I think the Brewers are comfortable taking a small step back, or maybe even more than a small step, but taking a step back in 2024 and kind of banking on more internal development and catching a few breaks here with some of their guys, you know, really breaking out to replace some of that Burns value. But they're comfortable doing that in the name of really adding to what could be a long-term core with, you know, Jackson Chourio about to make his major league debut. And now they've got DL Hall and Joey Ortiz joining that. And they have a bunch of young outfielders in Sal Frelick and Garrett Mitchell and Joey Weimer. And they, there's a lot of young guys kind of making their rise to the big leagues at the same time there. William Contreras had a great, you know, really strong season as in his first year in Milwaukee last year. It's all about, you know, kind of like putting together that next core. And then when those guys start to get closer and closer to free agency, you know, you repeat the process. But Arnold came from an organization that has, like I said, made an art or a science out of this. And we'll see if he's able to kind of emulate that success in Milwaukee. But I don't think this is the last move that they'll make this offseason. But I also don't think it is necessarily an indication that, like, okay, everything's for sale, they're going to trade everything that's not nailed down. That's not the way that they operate.
I agree with that general framing. But I also think if you're going to do this, if this is a semi step back thing, then you might as well trade Willy Adames at this point. I mean, if the plan is for 2024 to sort of see, you know, like you mentioned, Jackson Chourio is going to be debuting in center field, but he's still, what is he, 20, 21? However old he is, he's still very young.
Yeah, 20, I think, yeah.
still very young. You don't know, like, not even the top prospects. Sometimes there's an adjustment period or whatever.
He is 19 years old, just for the record.
There you go, 19 years old.
He'll be 20 in March, but
20 in March. Okay, yep. So incredibly young. You don't know how that's going to go, even though he's obviously incredibly talented. You know, if Joey Ortiz is part of your long-term shortstop plan after the Willy Adames era, you might as well start it now. And so, as much as I don't want them to tear it down or anything, but it's like, I mean, Adames is a free agent after 2024. Flip him for whatever pitching you can get, and let Ortiz take the job, see how he does. And then, I don't know, sign Gio Urshela to play third base or something, see how it goes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that they're, like you said, threading the needle. There's a way for them to trade Adames while also not totally tanking the thing, which was the same thing they did with Josh Hader, right? Like, they traded Hader and it didn't work out. Like, that season that they traded him ended up being poor, but then they, you know, got William Contreras and they were right back atop the division in 2023.
Yeah, so, and they have they still have their top, one of their top pitching prospects, Robert Gasser, came from that trade as well. So I think that the Hader trade, as unpopular as it was, will end up looking long term like a very shrewd, very good move for them. It just understandably and rightly pissed off a lot of fans at the time, and a lot of people in the Milwaukee clubhouse, like a lot of the players, were, you know, understandably frustrated to see that move come together.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll see what happens. It's I wouldn't be surprised by like any direction now with the Brewers, like if they just sort of sit tight with what they have now and see how it goes, or if Adames and Williams get traded, but they get traded for like win now pieces like Ortiz and Hall, like guys you can immediately plug onto the big league roster.
Right. It all comes down to what the offers are. I don't think they should just trade Adames for what a best offer. We'll take whatever you're going to give. But if they can get like a major league ready starting pitcher or something, sure, like that becomes feasible and plausible. But I think that's been their stance all offseason. It just took until early February, whenever the trade became official. Was it late January, early February, whatever? It took until the very late stages of the offseason for someone to meet that price on any of their big, you know, short-term pieces, and it happened to be Corbin Burnes.
Right. Okay, well, we have had so much to talk about that we haven't even gotten yet to the largest contract in Kansas City Royals history by a significant margin. That's like number three on our list of headlines to talk about this week. So Bobby Witt Jr. and the Royals sign an 11-year extension worth almost $300 million, basically $288.777777. There are also four opt-outs, and there's also, if somehow none of those opt-outs get used, there's also a three-year option at the end of the thing that can take it to 14 years and $377 million. Massive deal. The biggest contract in Royals history prior to this week was $82 million. So this is like, you know, between three and four times as large. Yeah. Huge deal for the Royals. But what were your thoughts on it, Steve?
I should preface this by I'm happy for Royals fans. I think it's awesome to see. There's a certain like nostalgic or like romantic like thing about like somebody like signing up to spend their whole career with one team. Like, it, all fans love that. I love that. I'm, you know, born and raised Minnesota, and we were the you know, Kirby Puckett and Ken Herbeck's team for a long time, and then Brad Radke spent his whole career in the Twin Cities, and there's been like guys like that, like, and Joe Mauer after that, like there's been guys like that throughout my, you know, entire life and baseball fandom as a Minnesota native. So I'm happy for Royals fans in that regard for sure, but I'm also, my inclination is also to kind of tell some of them to like pump the brakes a little bit, because I don't think this is quite that either. When you compare like Witt's extension to, say, you know, Julio Rodriguez's in Seattle, you know, after 7 or 8 years, I can't remember which, I don't have the numbers in front of me with Rodriguez, but the Mariners then have, you know, the option to basically re-extend him or pick up an 8 to 10 year club option. That's, you know, the size and length of it and everything are dependent on MVP voting. But basically, you know, the Mariners have the first right to say, okay, you know, we want to keep you in Seattle for the rest of your career and make you a lifelong Mariner. The Royals don't get that right. They bought out the rest of Witt's arbitration years and three free agent years that are guaranteed and locked in no matter what. But then for four straight years, Witt has the option to opt out. And if he continues to be the type of player that he was in 2023, which is, I think, what people generally expect of, you know, such a universally lauded prospect and former number two overall pick. And then you wonder, you know, okay, is this really just more of a 7-year deal with a bunch of opt-outs and kind of like what amounts to a $140 million insurance policy for Witt tacked on at the end, where if things go poorly, if he gets injured, if he, you know, regresses and somehow his career doesn't pan out the way that, you know, everyone largely expects it to at this point, you know, maybe then he'll end up, you know, staying throughout the life of the contract. But I think the general expectation should be that he's going to play really well for 7 years, and then he'll probably take that first opt out if his career continues on this trajectory. So then at that point, then, you know, the Royals will obviously, you know, have the opportunity to try to extend him again or keep him around. But the price will have significantly escalated and there will be less of his prime remaining, and it will be, you know, difficult for them to come to terms on that. So I hate to take that like pessimistic outlook on it for Royals fans. But it does not feel to me quite like, hey, this is a lifelong deal and Bobby Witt is in Kansas City to stay for the rest of his career. It's good and it's exciting for Royals fans. But I do think it's a little bit less than those kind of like deals we've seen where guys are willing to commit their entire career to one franchise.
Yeah. If you mentally prepare yourself for it by putting it in your head that he's going to opt out, then you have Witt through his, I think it's through his age 30 season.
Yeah.
Which lets you have what would have been his arbitration seasons. And then a few more, three more, I think.
Three more free agent years, which is great.
Yeah. So even if you just like mentally like lop off the end of the deal, then that's still an exciting thing to
100%
to get him 3 extra years. But for the team, like not the fans, but the team, they are taking on the risk.
Yes. That
things don't go according to plan. If he doesn't meet expectations or something, then that end of the deal that has been mentally lopped off becomes more real. But I mean, you know, he seems pretty good. He had a really good year.
He's really good. Yeah.
In 2023, like you mentioned, I think he came seventh in MVP voting, even though the team wasn't good, just because it was like 30 home runs and 40 something steals, whatever it was.
And the defense
really,
and the
really good shortstop defense, you know. And so, yeah, it seems like it'll be. I mean, you never know. You can't predict the future on these things, but he will play pretty good, and then maybe he'll end up signing somewhere else. We don't know.
Yeah, I think, too, like I said today, like it's one of those contracts that I like more for the player than for the team, and that doesn't necessarily make it a disaster for the Royals or anything like that by any means. Like, it's just there's downside, like, with major injuries or some unforeseen regression, where the only way he's going to stay through that full 11-year term is if, like, it's kind of a situation where the Royals wish he wouldn't stay for all 11 of those years. And I'm struggling to find a scenario where he foregoes all of his opt-outs, stays in Kansas City year to year for 4 years, and then somehow the Royals say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to pick up a 3-year, $89 million club option on you. Like, if he's declining those opt-outs each year, it's because he was hurt or his numbers don't justify like a return to the open market. So, like, in order for it to become that 14-year deal or whatever in $377 million, like, the only scenario where that really happens is he just isn't worth in his mind, like a trip back to free agency for each of the first, you know, three of those potential opt-out years. And then he just has this massive resurgence in after foregoing the fourth and final opt-out. And it looks like a decent deal at 3 years and $89 million. And I just don't think that's like a very realistic scenario.
Right. But what is, I mean, if there are Royals fans who are holding out hope of Witt staying for, you know, the next 15 years or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of times these opt-outs just give leverage to future negotiations. Like, yep. Yeah. Like, I think Manny Machado was a recent example where, he had an opt out and it was like 1 year until the opt out. And so him and the Padres were like, we don't want you to opt out. So like, let's work out a new deal. And so, you know, it might come to a point where everything is going well. Bobby Witt is like a perennial MVP candidate and everything is going well. And it's, coming up to 2030 and that opt out is looming and the Royals say, hey, let's, let's work out a new deal.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I think that's the best case scenario for the Royals. And that is a much more realistic scenario in my mind, where like he's just kind of ingrained in Kansas City, loves it, doesn't want to leave. And, you know, ideally the team has, you know, kind of risen around him as well at that point. And then, yeah, you find some common ground to make it work long term. But
right. And it seems like, you know, we talked about the risk of, you know, of if things don't go well, the team is on the hook for a lot of money, way more money than they've ever put on the line for any other player before. But it seems like we should at least address the fact that it might have something to do with PR purposes, because, you know, they have a new ish owner.
Yep.
Who just bought the team in 2019, I think. Tail end of 2019. Right. Yeah. And the team has been pretty bad for the 4-ish years that John Sherman, his name's John.
Yeah, and even before that, they've been fairly bad since their last, you know, since their back to back World Series appearances, really.
So it's been a bleak time, and he and the club are also trying to get some government funding for a new stadium. Mm-hmm. So trying to build up some goodwill and, you know, make Bobby Witt the face of the, like, hey, the good times are coming train to try to get this government money. So that's at least something that I think needs to at least be sort of said. I mean, we don't know for a fact that that's a motivation for the team, but obviously it helps to build some goodwill in the community to be like, hey, we're investing like we've never invested before. Sort of.
Right. I don't think they said like, hey, we need to, you know, build up this goodwill. Let's throw $300 million at Bobby Witt Jr. But like, I think it's naive to say that it wasn't at least like a tangential like consideration when they were going through the process and figuring out what they wanted to offer and figuring out like whether this was feasible for them.
Okay. Well, regardless, it's an exciting thing for Royals to just, I mean, when you're a fan of a team like that, these kinds of things don't happen every day. And something like this has actually never happened. So
it's exciting for them. Very exciting.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, so I'm going to wrap things up here. Well, there was so much going on, we didn't even have time to talk about the Jose Altuve extension, the White Sox making a bunch of trades, Ross Stripling going to the Giants. So much going on this week, but obviously we had to talk about the big stories. Kershaw back to the Dodgers. We didn't even really talk about that. But lots going on. Like we mentioned off the top, the baseball season never stops. And so that's why there's all this stuff happening in the first week of February. And by the time we record next week's episode, more stuff will have happened. And it will be spring training. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, absolutely. Always happy to be here. And we'll do it again soon.
Congratulations to Bart Giamatti's son on getting an Oscar nomination, and to everybody else. Keep checking MLBTradeRumors.com for all the latest news as spring training gets closer and stuff keeps happening. And if you sign up for the front office package, it's pretty cool because it gets the ads off the site, which, of course, you hate those ads. Get those out of there. And there's extra stuff. I will personally respond to your emails if you sign up, and various other benefits. So do that. It's a great deal. And we will talk to you with another podcast episode next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.